Charles Lim is a surgeon and a musician who researches the way musical creativity works in the brain. In a series of groundbreaking experiments, he put jazz musicians inside an fMRI to find out what the brain does during musical improvisation. The renowned bass player Mike Pope is one of his research subjects. That's him playing right now. And Strange Champs explores the science and the music.
Mike, that is just such a great version of the way you look tonight. You guys sound
Thank
like
you.
You're really cooking. How much of that is rehearsed and how much is improvised?
That arrangement was written, in terms of that counter line, that ba-da-bee-da-da-da, that thing, and then, of course, the melody. Those two things were written very much in the way that, like, a two-part Bach invention or something on a much simpler level would be written. And then the solo sections and the bridge, you know, when it starts to just swing. It's written, but it's not super specific. It's just, you know, general chord changes and melody and everything. Bass lines being made up, and the chords specifically are being made up. There's just a skeleton of stuff written.
So, Charles, listening to this, is this the sound of musical genius to you?
That's pretty cool, isn't it? It's kind of typical to me about how Mike thinks, meaning that, you know, you start with something familiar and known, and you take it to a place that's completely unexpected. I mean, I think that's what jazz is all about. I think every jazz musician is trying to squeeze something out of themselves that is new and unexpected and better than what they've heard or played before.
This is the kind of music you've begun investigating in your science lab. What are the kinds of questions that led you there? I mean, what is it you heard and wondered about in music like this?
For me, it has to do with kind of the mystery of who we are. I mean, how can we create these things? How do we generate novelty? And so what we've done is tried to design a series of experiments that allow us to look at the brain state in which one is able to play music, which is already a high-level cognitive activity on many levels, versus play something that they're generating spontaneously or improvising. And so the experiments are really designed to get at that difference. What changes in the brain when you go from doing something memorized or overlearned and transition into doing something improvised or created on the spot?
And so you put jazz musicians inside an fMRI and said, make music?
Something like that. I mean, to a certain extent. So there's a bunch of different experiments. But, you know, jazz players, first of all, if you put them in the scanner with the piano, they'll do that anyway, even before, you know, while they're setting up. You put a jazz piano down in this environment, put the piano on their lap, give them a set of headphones, and you go into the control room. Before you've even sat down to turn on your machines, they're already improvising. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just happens all the time. Really what we're doing is trying to set up a construct where we're in fact measuring brain activity in a pretty controlled way, yet to them doesn't feel that controlled, because what they're doing is something that they do all the time in music, and that's to either play a melody that they know or to improvise on that melody. I think what is lost here is kind of how remarkable a transformation neurologically that is.
Okay, so I have to say, I've been inside an MRI scanner, and there's not much room in that little tunnel.
That's right. No, it's tight.
Mike, how do you play music in there?
As my father would say, with great difficulty.
What are you actually playing? It's a tiny little keyboard?
It's a keyboard that Charles developed that's it needs to not have any ferrous metal in it, obviously, in order to be able to be operated in the presence of that strong magnet.
I'll tell you, for me, that piano keyboard took about 2 years to develop together with an engineer, and the day it actually worked, and I remember this very clearly, I couldn't believe that it actually worked without artifacts or some sort of glitch. I was literally like amazed. I was like, oh my God, this thing's actually working. And then I kind of paused. I was like, now what? You know? So there was a series of experiments. The first one literally was improvise on a 12-bar blues or play a memorized melody to the same 12-bar blues. And so that was the first experiment. That was kind of neat for us. And so the one that Mike alluded to earlier was sort of a follow-up experiment where, rather than just having one musician play the blues, is to have two musicians, one inside the scanner whose brain was being measured, and another one outside the scanner who was playing back and forth in a kind of trading fours paradigm, so that we could look at the brain mechanisms behind a musical conversation.
Did you see a difference in brain activity?
We absolutely saw really neat differences in brain activity. So in the first situation where a solo musician is just improvising, when you start improvising as opposed to memorizing, your brain changes remarkably. And one of the key changes is in the frontal lobes. We found a large part of the frontal lobe shut down. and this is sort of a self-monitoring, self-inhibitory region. And we had this other area turn up, which was a sort of autobiographical, self-referential area. So we had what we called a dissociated state of brain activity where one area went up and one area went down in the frontal lobes that was characterizing all the improvisational states.
So what is this autobiographical area that lights up?
So it was the medial prefrontal cortex. It's kind of a midline structure, meaning that it's sort of in the front of the brain towards the center. And this part of the brain is, it's very active when you're doing nothing, for example. So if you're doing a task, in between the tasks, it's very active because it's sort of the part of your brain that's active when you're not actually doing anything in particular. And so it's called what we call the default network. And so this default network is also involved by things such as telling a story about yourself, an autobiographical narrative. Also, if you have a musically evoked memory, meaning you hear a song and it reminds you of when you were 10, that area of the brain tends to be active. And so that's what I mean by a sort of self-referential, almost an inwardly directed area of the brain.
So what does it mean that that's the area of the brain that seems to be most active when musical improvisation is going on?
What we're interpreting this as meaning is that when you're improvising, you're telling your musical story. You are using your own voice, your own signature, your life experiences, your musical background, your skills to tell this musical story. And that's why it is autobiographical without using words when you're improvising. And also, you really are trying to generate more ideas, new ideas, rather than shut them down. You kind of want to turn on the faucet rather than turn off the faucet. And so I think that's part of why these self-monitoring areas turn off, because you're less concerned with making a mistake than you are with not playing safely. I mean, really, the goal is to go somewhere you haven't been before musically.
Mike, does that resonate for you? I mean, when you're improvising, does it feel to you as though it's a slightly different brain state?
Yeah, it undoubtedly is. The sensation that I have when I play is that my consciousness is essentially a conductor, and my motor nervous system is an orchestra, because the consciousness, the part that does inhibit, the part that's contemplative and all that stuff, can't do a good job of really making or playing music. It's not what it's there to do. And I mean, I've had experiences where I've played music and I've reacted to things that I've heard before I was conscious of the fact that they'd happened. I've actually played something in response to something I've heard and not known what it was until later when I thought about it.
So when you're improvising, are you thinking?
I'm thinking, but it's not linear thought. I'm not thinking along as I go. You know what I mean? I'm thinking maybe about a myriad of things, some of which may have nothing to do with the music. You know, I might just, you know, might be going, oh man, did I feed the meter or whatever, you know, but who knows? Again, it's not linear thought.
Does it feel good?
Yeah, it should. Yeah. I mean, when it's, when it's right. And that's one of the things about music that, to me, the thing that makes music not feel good is when there's no communication at all. That's the thing that makes it sort of sterile and it takes the life out of it, you know?
Well, that's actually why we did that experiment where we had two musicians playing back and forth, because we wanted to see what happens in the brain when you're having this kind of communication musically. And actually, these results are really kind of hot off the press, meaning that we're just actually analyzing them, but they've been really neat. We're definitely seeing language areas of the brain, classical language areas of the brain, lighting up when you're having a musical exchange that's improvised, but not a musical exchange that's memorized.
I believe that absolutely, personally. I mean, I 100% believe that to be true.
It was true in your brain, for sure. I saw it the other day.
Does it feel like you're having a conversation, Mike, when you're playing with another musician?
Yeah, it absolutely does. I even remember experiences, you know, early on when I was 16, 17 years old and doing a lot of playing. But I remember one experience in particular where I did a gig. It was like I had played real late the night before, and then I had to play super early the next day, and I was extremely, extremely tired. And I remember almost sort of hallucinating words to what I was playing. You know what I mean? I was so exhausted. I was closing my eyes, and I was really enthralled in what I was doing. And I can remember almost actually thinking a stream of words. Not quite. Like when you're in a dream state or a near sleep state, you think that you're thinking of words, and they're not actually words. They're just mumbo jumbo, but I don't know if that's ever happened to you, but that used to happen to me as a kid a lot. And I'd just be like, I'd wake up and I'd be like, what was that? That was the coolest word. It was the coolest way to say that. What was it? I could never think of it. And probably because it wasn't a word at all. It was some other kind of a thought. But anyway.
Charles, it's interesting. Are we? I have the sense, and I know you've said in other places that we're maybe on the cusp of developing a whole new science of creativity. That something very exciting is happening.
I think so, and I hope so. Creativity used to be something that artists and theorists, philosophers thought about more than scientists. I think scientists viewed it as kind of off limits or maybe too difficult to get to because scientists by nature are reductionists and we want to start with the building blocks and add one little piece to the next until you understand the whole thing. So what I think is happening though is that we have methods now that enable us to do things that we weren't able to do 20 years ago, 30 years ago, functional MRI being one of them but not the only one. And so with these new methods, we can really approach a whole new range of cognitive questions that I think get to the nature of art, creativity, genius, insight into a way that's more relevant and maybe more artistically genuine than has been done before.
Why is it that we humans seek creativity? Why does the brain seek creativity? Do we need it?
Does everyone's brain seek creativity, Charles? I mean, I don't know.
I've wondered this question a lot, meaning what, I guess another way to translate that is, what is the biological reward or the neurological reward we get when we recognize novelty in something? And we have this all the time, a sense of delight in jazz when you hear something unexpected or new, or when you're at a museum and you see a painting, you say, wow, look at that. There's a sense of, I mean, I can't describe it as anything else but some sort of neurological endorphin thing that you get where you think to yourself, huh, I just had a eureka moment that was induced by this other person's insight. And so there, I think there is a biological basis to this, and I think it has to do with the very core of how we survive as a species. I mean, we need to innovate and adapt in order to survive. If we don't, if we never evolve, we perish. Mm-hmm. And so I think we are actually hardwired to be attracted to new solutions.
Charles Lim is a surgeon at Johns Hopkins. He performs cochlear implants on people who've lost their hearing. Mike Pope is a well-known jazz bassist. They spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Coming up, why the smartest people may not be the most creative. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, The Creative Brain is part of our special series, Meet Your Mind, a user's guide to the science of consciousness. Brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.